Welcome to Financial Crime Matters with Kieran Beer. I'm Kieran Beer, Chief Analyst and Director of Editorial Content for ACAMS. In this episode, I talk with Daniel Stepano, currently a partner at Davis Polk & Wardwell, and someone who has spent more than 30 years with the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Dan discusses what we know about regulations implementing the Corporate Transparency Act and explains FinCEN's recent rulemakings requiring both registered investment advisors and real estate professionals to take on AML-CFT reporting responsibilities. I hope you find the podcast informative and that you subscribe to Financial Crime Matters, either on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or SoundCloud. Here we go.
AI-driven, market-leading, Symphony AI is transforming the fight against financial crime. Integrate AML, KYC stroke CDD, sanctions and fraud into a single platform with enhanced co-pilot skills that improve productivity. And discover Sensor AI for sanctions, an augmentation reducing false positives while achieving 100% true positive retention in a recent POC. Trusted by a third of the top 100 banks worldwide, Symphony AI offers everything, AML to zero tolerance. Find harmony for your financial investigation teams with Symphony AI.
Well, I'm really happy to be talking today to Dan Stepano, who is a partner at Davis Polk & Wardwell, and he is also someone who we know well. He is an advisory board member at ACAMS, and he had spent more than 30 years at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, including as deputy chief counsel from 2000 to 2016 before going into private practice. And Dan, it's really a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Kieran. It's a pleasure to be here with you, too.
So there is so much going on. I mean, it's kind of amazing. I almost don't know where to start as we look at the whole kind of regulatory regime that was set in motion by AMLA and the CTA and a world of enforcement actions out there. And I guess this is a chance for you to make it all clear to everybody. No pressure. I know we're not going to get to everything, but maybe one of the things that we should start talking about is CTA. The news always gets our attention. There are a number of challenges out there to the CTA. One, which has been kind of a surprise, at least to me, talk to me about challenges to the CTA, but particularly this decision by a federal judge in Alabama. And should we be alarmed?
No. I think it is a bit of a curveball. I think it is somewhat unexpected. You know, people who practice in this area, you know, lawyers and compliance professionals have been aware of this lawsuit, but I think it was generally regarded as being kind of borderline frivolous. The reason for that is just the body of law surrounding the Commerce Clause and other enumerated powers in the Constitution is quite broad. And I think that the consensus has been, and maybe still is, that the CTA is squarely within, you know, the Commerce Clause and other enumerated powers. But that's not what the Northern District of Alabama decided. They found that the CTA was, in fact, outside of the enumerated powers in the Constitution and applied what I would consider to be a pretty narrow reading of the Commerce Clause in particular. So, you know, what does this all mean? I mean, does it mean that the CTA goes out the window and we don't have to worry about it? Unfortunately, no, that's not the answer at all. Clearly, the decision applies in the Northern District of Alabama, and particularly with respect to the members of the National Small Business Association, who were the plaintiffs. My understanding is there's like 65,000 members. Now, Treasury's put out a notice just in the last couple of days. You know, they said that they will not apply the CTA to the plaintiffs. So if you are an entity that's a member of the National Small Business Association, you get a pass, at least for now. But as for the other 32 million reporting companies in the United States, they're not so fortunate. They have to comply with it. And I I fully expect the Treasury will appeal this decision, seek a stay. You know, I'm not a constitutional scholar, you know, but I think their chances on appeal are of getting this decision overturned are quite good. So we're telling our clients, unless you're in the Northern District of Alabama and a member of the Small Business Association, it should be business as usual, and you should continue with your plans to comply with the statute and the regulations.
And I know this has come up before. So that particular challenge to CTA, I wouldn't say you're dismissive exactly, but it's not one that you're taking as seriously right now. There are some others out there that come at it from a different philosophy. And you're the lawyer, so I'll count on you to phrase it correctly. But basically that are saying that the regulatory agencies exceed their authority when they dig down into details. I mean, traditionally, there's this view that Congress said, you guys are the experts. We're going to give you the broad outlines. You dig down on the details. And then there have been these court cases now, and again, I'm simplifying it, that say, no, Congress has to dot their I's and cross their T's and can't give the regulators that much discretion. So those challenges seem a little more real, particularly in some areas, right?
Yeah, what you're getting at, Kieran, I think, is this whole concept of Chevron deference, right? So Chevron was a Supreme Court decision from some time ago, which basically holds that if Congress passes a law that is ambiguous, that courts must defer to a reasonable interpretation of the law by the agency that is tasked with administering the statute. So that's Chevron, kind of from a high level in a nutshell. The case that is before the Supreme Court now that is going to test Chevron is called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. This is a little outside of my league here, but the case basically has to do with a Commerce Department regulation that requires certain fishing boats to pay for the government-imposed monitors that do safety checks and other things with respect to the boats. If you ever seen the movie Coda, there's a reference to this, you know, where they're the fishermen are all, you know, grumbling about having to pay for these monitors. Anyway, this is a potentially momentous decision because all federal agencies, certainly the OCC when I was there, relied heavily on Chevron. And a lot of this just has to do with the way laws are written. Generally, Congress is not that prescriptive when they write statutes. And I think their view is that the real experts are in the administrative agencies and that they leave it up to the agencies to flesh out the details of the requirements. That's what we're accustomed to. And, you know, the Corporate Transparency Act is kind of like that. I mean, you know, we have a broad statute and then we have specific regulations issued by FinCEN to implement it. But I think that right now, with a conservative majority on the court that is very skeptical of the expanding power of the administrative state, that this decision is probably going to be pared back at least. I don't know that they will, you know, get rid of it completely, but perhaps the level of deference that the court will apply going forward will be something less than what they're doing, you know, presently under Chevron. So this is this has application in all areas, not just, you know, our world of BSA, AML, but really, you know, kind of with the whole of government. So we're watching it closely and stay tuned.
Well, I guess, as you said, how it affects the details is a good place, a good transition into the next question in terms of details. And let's talk a little bit about some of the FinCEN rulemaking that's happened since you and I last talked about a year and a half. I think it's a little more than a year ago.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's a full year and a half. And at that time, there were a lot of questions. The three tranches of regulation, I guess, is how I describe them. The first being about who has to file under CTA, you know, what they must file. And then there's the accessibility one. And then there's that one that we're like waiting for Godot perhaps on, and that is how the CDD is reconciled to the CTA. So that long-winded thing. But tell me, we've had some guidance, some rulemaking since then. What do we know now that we didn't when you and I spoke? And I'm thinking about accessibility and who's going to have to register and all of that stuff. But we could start with accessibility.
Yeah. So we have a final access rule, which governs access to what FinCEN is now calling the BOIT system. I think before the acronym was BOSS or BOSS, which I kind of thought liked a little better, had a little more pizzazz to it. But BOIT system is now what FinCEN is calling the database of beneficial ownership information that it will house, that it is housing under the CTA. So the last time we talked, we had a proposed rule that was roundly criticized. I was among the group that was critical of it. There were a number of concerns with it. The biggest one really kind of had to do with the use of information that certain financial institutions would have. And it was very, very limited. It was limited to using the information to facilitate compliance with the CDD rule, not CDD generally, the CDD rule. So that limited, you know, who got access, and it limited what you could do with the information. Treasury got a lot of negative comments on this, including from, you know, the trade groups and, you know, the banks and other entities that were affected by it. And I think they took the comments to heart. I think they read them closely. And the final rule, from my perspective, is much, much better than the proposal. I've said this before, I've said it publicly, I'll say it again. It's very easy to be a critic when you're sitting there in the cheap seats lobbing grenades. And I think when the government does something right, I think they deserve credit for it. And I think that they did that here. The revised rule, it's much better. It makes it clearer who gets access, what you can do with the information, you know, once you have access, the confidentiality and data security requirements that will apply, et cetera. Basically, there are six categories of authorized recipients. There are federal agencies that are engaged in national security, intelligence, or law enforcement activity. So that's category number one. Second is state, local, and tribal law enforcement agencies. But here, there needs to be authorization from a court of competent jurisdiction for a law enforcement agency to seek that information to use it like in a criminal or civil investigation. So there is a requirement there. The third category are foreign law enforcement agencies or foreign prosecutors or judges, but they can only get access through an intermediary federal agency. Fourth category are financial institutions that will use beneficial ownership information to facilitate compliance with CDD requirements defined broadly, not just compliance with the CDD rule, but all of the AML, CFT requirements that would apply to financial institutions. They do need the reporting company's consent, and that's in the statute. FinCEN couldn't change that. Fifth category are federal functional regulators and other appropriate regulatory agencies that are acting in a supervisory capacity, right? So that would be your banking agencies, SEC, CFTC, et cetera. And then lastly, Treasury officers or employees whose official duties require access to BOI or disclosure for tax administration. So those are your six categories. What I think is kind of interesting about this is that FinCEN is phasing in access. So the rule's not effective yet, but what they're going to do in 2024 is give access to a handful of key federal agencies as part of a pilot program. This is kind of like a beta test just to see how it works. I'm not even sure what agencies they are. Presumably the heavier users, law enforcement and the like. The second phase will extend that access to Treasury offices and then certain federal agencies, so law enforcement, national security, et cetera. The subsequent stages extend it further to other federal agencies, you know, state, local, tribal law enforcement, federal agencies, you know, that are intermediaries for foreign requesters. And then lastly, financial institutions and their supervisors. So it's going to be some time before financial institutions will get access. And even that's phased as well. The institutions that are covered financial institutions for purposes of the CDD rule, so banks, broker-dealers, mutual funds, et cetera, they will be the first of the financial institutions that will get access. And then eventually, access will be extended to other financial institutions, like, for example, MSBs or crypto exchanges that are financial institutions for BSA purposes. And as far as timing of all this, what FinCEN has said is that they expect that financial institutions will get access around the same time that the amended CDD rule is in place. So presumably sometime about a year or so from now.
Interesting. So that is a step forward, I guess we can say.
Yeah. The million-dollar question now I think will become, when financial institutions get access to it, is will they use it? A sub-question is, will they be required to use it? I mean, so far, nothing that FinCEN has issued says that they're going to be required to use it. But I think that now that since they could use the information for broader AML, CFT compliance purposes, there may be institutions that will be more willing to access the BOIT system now than there would have been if the final rule was drafted like the proposed rule.
So let me quickly, I think a lot of attention is turned also to the release of a BSA regime, rulemaking around a BSA regime by FinCEN for RIAs. And I guess I want to kind of like a really quick overview of that. What does that mean? And what does it mean for our traditional audiences? And do we have like people joining us now who will be our brethren in having to abide by the BSA?
Yeah, well, misery loves company, I think. This is really, really a long time coming. This goes back 20 years. The last effort was a proposed rule in 2015. So it's taken, 9 years. Now, what FinCEN could have done, I suppose, was finalized that proposal, but they didn't do that. And that, I think that was wise on their part. A lot's happened in the last 9 years, and I think FinCEN wanted to take that into account. So they're starting the process again with another proposed rule. And what it would do in a nutshell is it would bring two categories of investment advisors into the world of being financial institutions for BSA purposes. So those are registered investment advisors, so advisors that have to register with the SEC, and then exempt reporting advisors that still have to file reports with the SEC. So they're both covered. They're bringing them in as full-fledged financial institutions that will be subject to the universe of BSA requirements, so program rule, SAR rule, etc. But this is interesting. With respect to the CIP rule, that's a joint rulemaking, and that's required by statute. So they won't be immediately subject to the CIP rule, but FinCEN has signaled its intent to work with the SEC on a joint CIP rule for investment advisors. So that one will be coming. And then with respect to the CDD rule, it sounds like what FinCEN proposes to do is to hold off on that until we have an amended CDD rule. So that one is coming too, but they won't be immediately effective. In other words, I think that the investment advisor rule will probably be effective before the CIP part of it and the CDD part of it as well is effective.
And so to put this in really concrete terms so that I can understand it better, what does that mean? When will securities firms, for instance, that have, or the big clearing platforms that have RIAs attached to them, when are they going to have to start doing something different? And what are they going to have to do different?
Okay, so the answer is it depends. Some members of the securities industry, like broker-dealers and mutual funds, they're already covered. And FinCEN has said this doesn't really change anything with respect to them. What it's really doing is, though, it's bringing in investment advisors that are not currently covered into this world of BSA compliance. So what they'll have to do is stand up a program, covering all of the pillars of the program, put in place transaction monitoring systems, monitor for suspicious activity, file SARs, et cetera, everything that other financial institutions do. Now, we work with investment advisors quite a bit. It is an area that presents considerable AML risk, and that's why FinCEN is acting here. But most of them at this point have had AML compliance programs. I think that one of the major impacts of this rule, though, is that it will level the playing field somewhat. It'll put them all under the same requirements and impose some consistency, across the industry, which is a good thing, and also provide some much-needed clarity. This is a step in the right direction, from my perspective. It's taken a long time, but, I think it's the proper move by FinCEN.
Well, speaking then of the other big initiative coming out in February, regulation around real estate. Talk to me about that. Does that mostly affect the real estate industry and not the banks and others that have been doing stuff to date?
It says with the investment advisors that are already subject to the BSA, if you are engaged in real estate activities in some way, providing settlement services, et cetera, and you are already subject to the BSA, this doesn't really change anything. What it does, it's somewhat limited in terms of its scope. FinCEN could have gone in the direction, as they did with investment advisors, fully bringing real estate professionals into the BSA AML rubric. And they didn't do that, right? So there's no program requirement for real estate professionals. What they've done is they've recreated a reporting regime, sort of a SAR type of report, not exactly a SAR, but kind of like a SAR.
SAR light,
SAR like, you know, something in the SAR area. And it applies to this cascade of functions. Right? This is going to sound kind of weird. Real estate businesses do a number of things in connection with the sale of real estate. And by the way, what we're talking about here are non-financed cash transactions of residential real estate. So if it's financed, you know, the banks kind of pick that up, other lenders. So they're not going there, and it's limited to residential, right? So, and I'm not sure exactly why. Perhaps they think there's greater risk with residential, but it's limited to residential. Anyway, the cascade begins with real estate professionals who provide certain settlement services in the process. Like, for example, serving as a closing agent or a settlement agent or preparing a closing or settlement statement. So that's sort of like the highest level. And then, you know, it's followed by persons that underwrite title insurance and then dispersing the greatest amount of funds, evaluating title status, et cetera, I won't go through all of them. But the concept is the business that performs a function that is the highest on the list has this reporting obligation. It's like almost like a waterfall that you have to go through. The parties can also agree by written agreement who is going to be the real estate business that has to make the filing. So apart from the cascade, they can also decide among themselves who it's going to be. And as I say, the obligation is to file the real estate report, kind of like a SAR, that includes information such as the beneficial ownership of the transferee entity or the transferee trust, individuals that represent the transferee, the reporting person and seller, property and payments made, et cetera. So this is a new requirement. And I guess what it means is that this is going to supersede the existing approach that FinCEN has taken of issuing geographic targeting orders for real estate. I mean, I think this is the successor.
And I was going to say that unlike this takes in a lot of a bigger universe of real estate professionals, whereas the geographic targeting orders was really the insurers for title insurers and everything really wasn't it pretty much. So let me go on to go to your expertise to get some advice out of you here for people out there who may be concerned about potential enforcement actions and what they mean to them. Seems like we've had a little bit of an uptick in. There's some dramatic actions, but an uptick in at least the number of ones associated, for instance, with third-party relationships in fintechs. And obviously, this is huge right now because everybody's beefing up their services by taking on, you know, being on other platforms and whatever, as I understand it. There is, in addition, the outsourcing of some compliance function, too, that is part of these third-party things. So I guess those are two things, but they seem related, right? Anyway, put them into perspective for me. Not asking too much here, but except for a clarity and put them into perspective.
Wow, that's a pretty high bar. Okay, this is a huge area from an enforcement perspective. We are representing a number of banks that have fintech partners, some of which are subject to enforcement actions. And, you know, it's almost like I can barely turn on my computer in the morning without reading about some new enforcement action being taken, typically against a bank that has fintech partners and offers banking as a service, product offerings of that type. Why is this a big deal? A couple of things. The one is that these partnerships are very attractive to banks and fintechs. They're attractive to banks, particularly smaller banks that are looking for alternative sources of revenue. A lot of smaller banks have really gotten squeezed in recent years, and you know they're looking for ways to make more money. So if they partner with a fintech, the fintech is able to bring them customers and deposits from literally all over the country that they wouldn't normally get. So it's very attractive from the bank's perspective. It's also attractive from the fintech's perspective because the fintechs can't really offer a full array of bank product and services on their own. They have to have a bank partner to do that, you know? So it makes sense from a business perspective for these types of entities to align with each other. The problem, though, is that the fintech customers can basically transact through the bank. Like under banking as a service arrangements, they can get loans, they can have, you know, FDIC insured accounts, et cetera. But in many cases, if not most cases, the bank has no contact with the individual customers of the fintech, you know, the customer's customers, if you will. So this is where the AML risk, I think, really comes in. And it really requires the bank to depend upon the AML controls of their fintech partner to a large degree. As long as there's an alignment between the bank and the fintech partner in terms of applying an effective AML program, you know, it can work. But if there's a misalignment, you know, if there's differences in, you know, compliance culture, compliance approach, risk appetite, weak controls, whatever, that's where you could have problems. And the banking regulators are just all over this. There are ways to mitigate these risks. And, you know, what we tell our clients is that, you know, if you want to go down this path, you know, you need to make sure that you have a strong risk assessment up front, you know, of whether your own program is going to be adequate to oversee this, and then the program of your fintech partner, and that you do ongoing due diligence over the fintech partner. There needs to be a strong contract in place so that everybody understands who is responsible for what when it comes to AML compliance. And we've assisted some of our clients, you know, in drafting these contract provisions. And then oversight, you know, audit, the ability to, you know, audit fintech partner and make sure that they're, you know, complying with the requisite procedures. About a year ago, the banking agencies finalized their third-party risk management guidance. This is not an AML guidance document. It applies beyond fintech partnerships, right? It applies to all third-party type of relationships, vendors and alike. This is something that, you know, every banker that uses third parties, which is pretty much every banker, should read closely and then, you know, put under their pillow at night, because the regulators, when they examine banks that have third-party relationships, they are examining them for compliance, essentially, you know, with this guidance. So, this is really key. And, you know, the big mistake here is to, if you're a bank, is to get into a relationship like this and just say, okay, well, you know, these customers aren't our customers. We don't have to worry about it. That's a fintech problem. That's a formula for disaster. And we've seen a few disasters out there, right? If you approach it the right way, I think that these are manageable risks and they could be mutually advantageous to the bank and the fintech, but it has to be approached the right way.
What are you seeing out there that keeps you awake at night, or that you're comforted by, or what's on the horizon?
Well, it's a kind of a hard question. The biggest issue on the horizon, you know, from a regulatory standpoint, is going to be the amendments to the CDD rule. And I'm very eager to see FinCEN's proposed rule. I know I'm not alone in that thinking. And this is going to have a huge impact on banks and other institutions that are covered institutions for purposes of the CDD rule. Those two areas, I guess, you know, bank fintech partnerships for sure, and then CTA compliance generally, I think those are probably the two areas.
Well, I think we're all waiting on that, the CDD rule and how it gets amended and everything. And that's a little hint to FinCEN, if they could do that in conjunction with one of the conferences. I know we're going to see you in Hollywood, Florida. We don't expect it that soon. Maybe in Vegas, we can get something to chew on with the audience about what the CDD rule looks like. Because I imagine it's going to be quite interesting and perhaps a little confusing initially as people figure out how to integrate it.
My read on it is this. If you look at the CTA itself, it's very interesting what they did, right? You don't see this all the time in statutes. They basically directed FinCEN to rescind virtually the entirety of the existing CDD rule. There's one paragraph left, you know, that's the basic banks have to have risk-based procedures to verify the identity of their legal entity customers, beneficial owner, something like that. That's it. Everything else goes. So it's kind of like a complete revamping. But, you know, what do they do? Well, the statute says that FinCEN is tasked with issuing conforming amendments to the CDD rule. Well, conforming to what? conforming to the CTA. This is going to get very, very tricky because of some of the differences between the existing CDD rule and the CTA and the implementing regs of the CTA. Just to give you two very quick examples, you know, the one is the definition of beneficial owner. And the way beneficial owner is defined under the existing CDD rules, you could never have more than five, right? Because 25% is the threshold under the ownership prong plus one control person. You only have to identify one control person. So four plus one is five. That's not true with CTA. I mean, they've maintained the 25% threshold for ownership, but this term substantial control has no limits on it. So banks could go from having to collect beneficial ownership information on five individuals to 10 or 15 or 20 and maintain and refresh that information for the life of the relationship. That is a huge, huge change. So that's number one. The second thing is if you look at, you compare the exclusions from the term legal entity customer that are in the CDD rule. There's 16 of them. But then if you look at the exemptions from the definition of reporting company, there's 23, and it includes this giant exemption for, you know, so-called large operating companies, which don't have to be that large. 20 employees in the U.S., more than 5 million in sales or revenues. Presumably, what happens is we end up with a CDD rule that looks more like the CTA. Potentially, it could result in, I think, pretty significant expansion of the compliance burdens for covered institutions. But, you know, we'll have to see.
So is it a step forward or a step back? Well, if you want.
It's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to be like against financial transparency. The one concern I've kind of had, you know, when I start thinking about, the BOIT system and everything that's been stood up and the effort behind it, my sense is that 99% of the people that comply with this are going to be like law abiding, right? The ones that you want to get are going to be the criminal organizations, and I don't know if they're going to comply with any of this, right? So it may be this massive effort to collect information on, you know, people who are law abiding, you know, that aren't money launderers or drug traffickers or anything, you know, bad like that. But, you know, my friends in law enforcement tell me that there is a great deal of value in collecting this information. It helps them to connect the dots when they're doing, you know, financial investigations. So I have to defer to them on that. So bottom line, you know, I think it's a step forward. I just hope that the changes to the CDD rule are reasonable and workable and put us in a better place, not a worse place.
Well, Dan, I'm grateful that you will be around to guide us through those changes. And I'll have to figure out whether I end up calling it BOIT or something, since it's the BOIT. But anyway, thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Karen. Pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Dan Stepano, partner at Davis, Polk & Wardwell. I hope you found the podcast compelling and that you will subscribe to Financial Crime Matters on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or SoundCloud so that you'll receive an alert for each new podcast. Because financial crime matters to me and to you. See you next time.